I'm Marcus Smith, and this is Constant Wonder. Over 1,000 people gather on an Italian beach. That's not so odd now, is it? The Italian Riviera, that's a big draw. But I'm talking June of 1946. It's the middle of the night, and these people are not supposed to be there. Neither is the ship that comes to pick them up. Nobody is vacationing there. These are refugees, and it seems that no country wants them. Of course, rejection is a common experience for large groups of refugees, but you might think that just a year after the German surrender at the close of World War II, things ought to be normalizing a bit. And yet, how could they? The war had been a cataclysmic event with displaced people all across the heart of Europe and elsewhere around the world. We're going to learn about this group of refugees and the story that they have. It extends back to before they gathered on that beach. We're going to talk about where they went also after boarding that ship. It is a story of drama, struggle, compassion, bureaucracy, suspicion, and secrecy. It's the story of an underground that had work to do even after the conclusion of World War II. Rosie Whitehouse joins with us now from the UK. She's a journalist and editor. She's been senior producer and presenter for the BBC World Service. She's author of The People on the Beach, Journeys to Freedom After the Holocaust. Such a pleasure to have you with us, Rosie.
Thank you for having me.
Well, I want to start with the image of that boat. You know, so many stories are focusing right off the bat about people. We're going to get there, but the boat, the Josiah Wedgwood, it was called. How big a vessel are we talking about?
Well, actually, it wasn't called the Josiah Wedgwood when it sailed up to the tiny beach of Vado on the Italian Riviera. It was still known as the Berger Noir. And it was a former Canadian corvette, which had been used in the Second World War in the Battle of the Atlantic. Now, any of you who know your ships will know that corvettes are designed for a crew, a very small number of crew, maximum about 60 people, and they're famous for their rolling as they cross the seas. So it was very far from an ideal boat in which to basically stash 1,300 people and sail them out across the Mediterranean.
And why the middle of the night for this?
Well, because this boat was a top secret boat. This is a story about people smuggling. And the people smugglers in this case were the Jewish underground, who were trying to get Jewish refugees out of Europe. Now, those refugees felt they had no future in Europe, and we can come to that in a moment. But the reason that the boat arrived in the middle of the night is because this was a top secret operation, and the enemy here were actually the British. British forces in northern Italy were trying to prevent the Italian underground taking illegal immigrants into the Palestine Mandate, which was then under the control of the British Empire.
So this is a story that sounds kind of obscure to me. I mean, not a lot of people would even know about this.
Well, I don't think it was obscure, really, because it's actually the thing here is that this is a story which has been convenient for both sides to forget. Actually, I don't know if you are aware of this, but over the last couple of years, there's been a major debate here in the UK about the construction of a Holocaust memorial alongside Parliament on the banks of the Thames. It's been a very heated debate about why it should be constructed next to the Queen of all parliaments. But the argument is centered on a small little garden, which is next to the House of Lords. But my reservations about this monument being built there is that it will reinforce the idea that the British were the saviors of the Jews of Europe when they went to war against Germany, which is far from true because the British had already been at war with Jews for some time. And in March 1939, the British government introduced severe restrictions on immigration to the Palestine Mandate. Now, this was at a crucial moment when Nazi policy was to get all Jews out of the Reich. out of Germany and the recently annexed Austria. And when the gates of Palestine were closed by the British, it confounded a problem that the Jewish refugees had nowhere to go. Now, during the war, the things were put on hold, but after the war, it was decided. Originally, the Labour government, which won a landslide victory, promised to rescind the white paper. But when they came to power, they decided not to do so. And that meant that hundreds of thousands of Jewish Holocaust survivors were trapped in Europe with nowhere to go, because it was extremely difficult to get visas to come to Britain proper, to go to Canada or to go to the United States. And there were very few places which you could go if you found yourself stuck in the displaced persons camps in Germany. Now, it's also a convenient story for Jewish people to have forgotten, or the Israeli authorities to have ignored, because this is a story of underground activities. It's a story of rescuing Jews. And unfortunately, rescuing Jews did not come to an end at the end of the Second World War. It continued and continues on to this day. The reason that we can tell this story now is because the methods that are used have changed very radically. But the Jewish underground who rescued the Jews in from Italy were the same Jewish underground who rescued Soviet Jewry. So this was a very sensitive story for which the Israelis themselves chose not to tell for obvious and sensible reasons. Now we can safely tell this story.
So we're going to talk more explicitly about the underground, who was spearheading the effort and all of that. But first, I just want to be absolutely clear here. The story that you have just woven for me is that doors were closed before the war. You were trapped and doors closed during the war. And for Jews after the war, doors still closed.
Absolutely. And it's one of the little known facts about the Holocaust. So people assume that the Nazis came to power with a blueprint to exterminate European Jewry. That was far from the case. The policy of genocide developed over a period of years. And initially, after the annexation of Austria, the policy was to expel the Jews, to get the Jews out of the Reich territory. And it's only when there was nowhere to go that the policies began to change and began to radicalize and to develop into deportation and then to eventually develop into mass murder.
So you've just explained for me that phrase, the final solution, because it would be too easy just to think of that as being kind of I don't know how to say it, almost a metaphor, but it actually is just the last one they came up on after all other options.
The final solution is what was introduced. It came about after the invasion of the Soviet Union, because once you had the invasion of the invasion of the Soviet Union brought with it the possibility that Jews could be resettled in Siberia. But, of course, as we all know, the invasion of the Soviet Union was a failure, and the Nazis found themselves bogged down in the frozen wastelands of Russia. And at that point in December 1941, it was clear that this was not going to be a blitzkrieg war of defeat in the East, and that there was going to be nowhere that they would be able to resettle the Jews. The Jews also, it really became a war not just against the Soviet Union, but it was a second sub-war against the Jews, and all Jews in Europe were the enemy of Nazi Germany. So that's when you get the Wannsee Conference, and at the Wannsee Conference, the decision that Hitler had taken in December 1941 to murder European Jewry is actually laid out in a policy document.
Yeah. Well, let's talk about the people at the head of this operation. Who were they? Was it a cadre of individuals? Was there one leader of them all?
There was a myriad of people. And again, actually, I'm going to take you back to the period before the war so that you can understand actually what was happening. Because in the 1930s, particularly after Kristallnacht in 1938, there was a huge movement to rescue Jews from Germany, from Austria, and from occupied Czechoslovakia. That movement came to a pinnacle under Kindertransport, in which 10,000 Jewish children were brought to the UK. Now, the people who organized this were Jews on the ground in Germany and Austria, Jews here in the UK, and other Jewish organizations around Europe who helped people to escape. And the Italian Jewish community was part of that movement. And they, even though they had gone underground after the racial laws were introduced in Italy, they still continued to help foreign Jews, and then they began to help their own people who became increasingly in danger. Now, when the war came to an end, these organizations still existed. An Italian Jewry stood up, dusted themselves down, and began to help people. Organizations like the American Joint Jewish Distribution Committee, who remained present in Europe throughout the Second World War, were still there, and they began to operate, and they had throughout the war been investing money to help Jews, to help Jewish resistance movements across Europe. So many of these bodies were the same bodies that we'd seen playing out in the 1930s. Now, there was also two key elements which were relatively new to the ground. One was Jewish resistance movements themselves, the partisans, who carried on their fight to protect the Jewish people after the liberation, and played a very important part in the Jewish underground and the rescue of Jews from Europe and their resettlement in Israel. And then, of course, we get the Jewish authorities in the Palestine Mandate, who had a security operation, which was began to operate in Europe before the liberation, when agents were dropped behind enemy lines to help the survivors.
You know, I can't even imagine an organization persisting that long from before, you know, from the 30s all the way till post-war. You think of the underground as being something that emerges within the context of the war, but it was going on well before that.
Yes, I think it's always one of these problems with history, is that, you know, we try to compartmentalize it and put it in little filing boxes, but it doesn't really work like that, and particularly not when you're looking at Jewish history and the growth of Jewish identity and its association with Zionism, and then the challenges that the Jewish people faced, which of course began in the context of the Holocaust in 1933, but did not cease after the end of the Second World War, which I think is something that we ignore at our peril.
We're going to go back to that beach with the story where we began everything and get more of a picture of how that all transpired. We're talking with Rosie Whitehouse about her book, The People on the Beach, Journeys to Freedom After the Holocaust. This is Constant Wonder. Stay tuned. I'm Marcus Smith, and this is Constant Wonder. It's a pleasure to have Rosie Whitehouse with us, talking about her book, The People on the Beach, Journeys to Freedom After the Holocaust. This is about 1946, the pivot point that is the focal point of the title of her book. The Italian Riviera, people amassed 1,300-some refugees in the middle of the night to be whisked away, if you can get across the Mediterranean quickly, to Palestine. How did that all play out? That's the story we're pursuing. So Rosie, somebody has to retain the services of a ship. Somebody has to send out word where to gather. This operation sounds very complex.
It was extremely complex, and we have to remember that the ship, which was later renamed the Josiah Wedgwood, had actually sailed from New York, and it was the first time that the Jewish underground had actually taken a ship from America, sailed it across the Atlantic, and then filled it with refugees and tried to smash through the Royal Naval blockade of the Palestine Mandate.
Yeah. So who pulled it off? I mean, I've got a couple of names I know from your book, but, I mean, can you give credit to any particular group of heroes here?
Well, there are plenty of heroes, and actually I was delighted to find that many of the heroes in this story are also women. One of the key players on the ground in Italy was a lady called Ada Sereni, who was a Jewish lady who had been born in Rome. She came from a very wealthy, almost aristocratic Jewish family, and she was married to a man who history has forgotten, but if he hadn't been murdered in Dachau, would have become, I think, a very famous Israeli politician. His name was Enzo Sereni, and he was one of those agents who were parachuted into Europe before the liberation by the Jewish agency, and as I said, he was murdered in Dachau. Now, Ada Sereni went to Italy. She was living obviously in Palestine. She went to Italy to try to find out what had happened to her husband, but then she became the deputy leader of the Jewish underground, and she was an extraordinary woman. And because she knew her way around all kinds of aristocratic circles in Italy, she was able to commission a number of boats, 56 in all, and to organize the transit of refugees, Jewish refugees, firstly into Italy, then to look after them. Many of them spent well over a year in Italy, and then to organize their secret transportation to embarkation points. So Ada Sereni was an extraordinary woman, and she's actually one of the people who carried on working in the underground. She went on to work in the rescue of Soviet Jewry, which I mentioned earlier.
Now, before we leave Ada Sereni, you said 56 vessels that she arranged for. Did all of these vessels make their journeys under the same cloak of secrecy, or was the blockade lifted? How does that work?
They all did. Yes, they all did. Some of the initial boats were very small. And at first, when the boats tried to smash through the Royal Naval blockade, they were boarded by Royal Marines, and they were towed into Haifa Harbour, and the people were then put in the internment camp at Atlit, where they spent some weeks until they were processed, and then they were actually allowed to leave. Let's not get too dramatic here, but Atlit is a really quite a shocking place to see. It has wooden watchtowers, which look like they might be equally at home in Majdanek concentration camps. So you can imagine just turning up there if you were a concentration camp survivor. But what's very important about the book that I've written about the Josiah Wedgwood is that it was the largest boat to try to smash through that blockade, and it shocked the British. And after that, after the arrival of the Josiah Wedgwood, the British government made the decision to intern those Jews who tried to break through the blockade on Cyprus, and that really turned the heat up in this run up to Israeli independence.
So what about publicity, negative publicity for what the British were doing? Did that help to turn the tide eventually? I'm wondering how their efforts to keep the blockade intact finally collapsed.
Well, their efforts to keep the blockade intact did not collapse because of public opinion here in the UK. Public opinion in the UK was very supportive of British government's activities, and it was whipped up by the popular press. The popular press always caused a lot of problems here in the UK. We've seen that in the run-up to Brexit, and it was exactly the same back in the 1940s when they had splashed all over the front covers the murder of British officers by the Jewish underground in Palestine, which whipped up emotions here, and thousands of people took to the streets in the spontaneous anti-Jewish riots. Tensions were very high. They were very high here in the UK, where many British Jews were part of this underground movement, trying to help refugees, also going as foreign fighters to fight in Palestine. So tensions were very high. It was actually the pressure from the United States that in the end changed the course of history, and basically the British just threw the towel in and said, right, we've had enough.
Didn't the United States play the same kind of card in terms of not wanting to accept refugees?
Yes, the United States was exactly the same. Life was very difficult for Jews in America at this period. I mean, they were very nervous about accepting vast amounts of Jewish refugees, both before and after the war. They felt that the arrival of lots of Holocaust survivors, who people regarded as damaged goods, would actually impact very negatively on their own standing within the community.
Yeah. Well, it's not a
black and white picture in the way that it's portrayed in movies like Exodus with Paul Newman. It's a much more nuanced story, and I think that's the key thing that we have to understand now, particularly when we look at how history is weaponized, and the story of the founding of the State of Israel is certainly one of those pieces of history which has been weaponized.
It would be one thing to just try to imagine what the experience would be for a single refugee coming to that beach, boarding that ship, moving out in the dark waters towards the east. But have any of those people been interviewed? That generation, of course, many of them having passed on. But do we have firsthand accounts?
Yes. I did meet people who sailed on the Wedgwood. And actually, I deliberately did not meet them until I had done all of my research. Now, I'm not a historian. I'm a journalist, and I'm also a travel writer. So my natural reaction when I discovered this story was to get in my car and to drive the route that the people took out of Europe and to find out why they left. Because Jews left communities where they had lived for hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of years to go to Palestine, which, after all, was a country which was immensely unstable and where life was extremely hard. So my question was, why did they do this? Now, many of the people, first the other problem I had is that because, of course, the Josiah Wedgwood was a refugee boat, and you don't keep logs of passengers on refugee boats. But as I mentioned, that when the boat tried to smash through the Royal Naval blockade, those people on board it were arrested and taken to the Atlit Detention Center, where their names were taken down. And by discovering their names and the places that they were born, I was able to begin to track them down. Now, a lot of the people who traveled on this boat were actually relatively young when they did so. This is an interesting demographic question as to why there were so many teenagers and 20-year-olds on this boat. But luckily for me, there were a lot of people who were in their late teens and early 20s, which means that quite a number of them are still alive, and that I was able to track them down, or they had lived long enough to give testaments in the 1990s. And yes, their stories were really revelatory. I'll give the example of one man who was 16 when he traveled on the Wedgwood. His name is Yitzhak Kaplan, and he lives in Haifa. And he came from a city which today is called Rivne, but before the Second World War was called Rovna. Today it's in Ukraine, but before the Second World War it was the most easterly town within Poland. And it was the first city that's been in Poland to be liberated by the Red Army. It was liberated in February 1944. Now, Kaplan's family part of his family had been in the Soviet Union in hiding during the war, and they returned to Rivne. His sister had married a partisan, and he was one of the partisans who'd taken part in the liberation of the city. Now, Kaplan had another sister who had stayed behind in Rovna, and she and her children had been murdered in one of the largest massacres on the Eastern Front in the Sosenki Forest, where 23,000 people were murdered in November 1941. Now, I naively assumed that that was the reason that his family left and felt that they had no future in Rovna. I was surprised when I met Yitzhak Kaplan, because he told me that that was not the case, that they had returned to Rovna hoping to rebuild their lives. but it was the civil war on the ground between Ukrainian nationalists and the Soviet army and Soviet forces, which made their life impossible. Also, the partisans, when they were helping the Jewish survivors to rebuild their lives, found themselves in a head-on collision with the Soviet Union, which was increasingly anti-Semitic. And basically, the partisans were given the tip-off that if they didn't leave, they could find themselves in Siberia. So the reason that the Kaplan family left Rovno was because they fled from Stalinism, not as a result of the Holocaust. And it's kind of logical when you think about it, because the Nazis were occupying forces. Many of the Ukrainian nationalists cooperated with them, but a number of people didn't. Another one of the survivors that I met on the boat was actually hidden by a leading Ukrainian nationalist, and that was how he survived. So I was very surprised to find that these were desperate refugees who were actually fleeing from Stalinism. Now, the Kaplan family set out to try to find a way out of Europe in the late summer of 1944. Now, let's just put this in context. This is when Auschwitz was working at full fettle, burning the bodies of Hungarian Jewry. The fighting was still fierce across large tracts of Europe. These were really desperate people who, if you would consider that you would set out across a war zone to try to make your way to the Mediterranean to get to Palestine. So these people were incredibly, incredibly desperate. And I think that that's something that people have overlooked. You always see when you read the stories of Holocaust survivors, oh, blah, 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 was liberated at X. And then in 1948, they went to live in Palestine or the United States. But nobody ever bothers to say what happened during the moment of liberation and the moment they were actually able to begin a new life.
I guess I'm learning here that you have a major world cataclysm, and even with a ceasefire, there's no returning to the status quo ante.
There wasn't, actually. And I think but the question is, why? Where did the people on the boat come from? Now, apart from one child who came from the south of France, everyone on the boat, nearly all of them, came from Eastern Europe. They came from Poland, they came from Romania, and they came from what we now call Western Ukraine. Now, these were areas where the Second World War was fought at its worst. These were the real killing fields where the war destroyed the fabric of society and there was no turning back. It was a very different situation in France, for example, where my husband's family survived the Holocaust, where it was possible to try politically to switch the clock back and to pretend that nothing had happened. And it's one of the reasons that so few French Jews did not join this mass exodus to the Palestine Mandate.
I'm very interested in the way you stumbled across this story, because that's quite a story in itself.
Well, as I said earlier, I'm also a travel writer, and I was writing a guidebook to Liguria, in which the Italian Riviera is situated. And I'm very interested in the post-war history of Italy, so I began typing in the names of the principal towns and putting 1945, 1946 after their names. And when I put in Savona, 1946, up popped this newspaper cutting. And I thought, this is extraordinary. What is this story? We spent a lot of time in Italy, and my father-in-law worked in shipping in Italy, and we have a lot of people who still work in that kind of industry who are friends of ours. And then I was very surprised when I began to ask my husband and then to ask questions of people that we knew, like, what was this ship? What was going on? And people looked at me completely blank. And So my natural reaction was to go down to the beach that the ship had sailed from and see if I could find anybody who remembered it. And luckily for me, I discovered a fisherman who was tying up his nets, who had been a little boy at the time.
No. This is too good to be true. You're a journalist and you get your information from a fisherman tying up his nets down on the beach.
Well, that's what journalism is. It's all about luck, I have to tell you that. You know, we just went down to the beach at the right moment that this gentleman had just come back from his fishing trip. But also journalism is all about guts and being nosy and going up to people and going, oh, by the way, do you know anything about this? And this 88-year-old man goes, yes, I certainly do. And he describes having seen the refugees on the beach. Now, at this point, I assumed that I would go back to my house and that I would go on Amazon and I would buy a book which would supply all the answers to what these people were doing on the beach, how they got there, who had paid for it, and what was this mysterious boat. I didn't realize that I would have to drive hundreds and hundreds of miles, that I would have to read hundreds and hundreds of books, and then I would have to write the book myself, which offered the answer to the question.
So you found the story of these 1,300 people who make their way. I just have to know, in everything you learned, was there ever a moment as this unfolded, the events back in 1946, was there ever a moment when the organizers of this resistance movement felt almost completely thwarted in their efforts?
No, I think that I think that's all part about of being survivors. I mean, these people had come from hell, so that, you know, they weren't going to stop. They were determined to go to Palestine. They felt that that was where their future lay. It's an interesting story in itself to stop them and to ask them, hey, why was that? Why did you not want to go somewhere else? Or why didn't you go home? But these were people with enormous agency and determination. I mean, if anything really shocked me while I was researching this story was the fact that nobody else had come across it before. And I must say there are moments that I actually thought, have I gone completely mad? Why has nobody else noticed this story? And I think it's actually because it took such considerable effort to unearth it, and also that it came about at just the perfect moment, because if I had tried to research this story even 10 or 15 years before, the internet resources would not have been there to allow me to do so. And I was able to search for the identities of people in numerous languages that I don't speak, thanks to Google Translate. I was able to hunt down stories which would have been virtually impossible 15 years ago.
Yeah.
But also, once I had found the stories and I had found the history of the period, I still had survivors who were alive and able to talk to me. So it was really a magical moment in history where everything came together at the right moment.
And just to follow up on my previous question about did anybody ever feel thwarted in their attempt to get there, I guess the corollary is, was anybody ultimately turned away?
Ultimately, yes. I mean, after the Josiah Wedgwood, we get the famous story of the Exodus, in which the British decided that rather than interning the 4,000-odd refugees on the Exodus in Cyprus, that they would send them back to France from where they'd sailed. Those refugees eventually ended up being forcibly disembarked in Hamburg and being detained in displaced persons camps in the British sector in Germany. But nearly all of those people were spirited out by the Jewish underground and made their way eventually to Palestine. So, no, very few people were thwarted in what they wanted to do. I mean, there were, unfortunately, some boats that sank and some people didn't make it. But, you know, this was a desperate period, just as we see now with refugees. Not everyone is lucky enough to make it and can end up, you know, dead on the beach.
A very important and very dramatic story, and a pleasure to hear you tell it. Rosie Whitehouse, thanks for being with us.
Thank you for having me.
Journalist and editor Rosie Whitehouse, her book is titled The People on the Beach, Journeys to Freedom After the Holocaust. Getting in and out of Europe to assist Jews was no easy matter, not even after World War II and the Holocaust, but especially perilous during the war. We were surprised to learn that some brave Jewish women who had escaped during the war actually chose to sneak back in, right into the killing zones, to help others survive. It's an extraordinary tale of heroism coming up next on Constant Wonder. Thanks for listening to Constant Wonder. I'm Marcus Smith. During the earliest years of World War II, Jewish communities in Eastern Europe were cordoned off into ghettos, where sickness and starvation would do the work that later on concentration camps would take over. But amidst this suffering, extraordinary stories of heroism, including many Jewish women who actually assumed disguises to move around the country and smuggle in supplies and information. To learn more about it, Eric Schultzke spoke with Judy Battalion, who is author of The Light of Days, The Untold Story of Women Resistance Fighters in Hitler's Ghetto.
It was easier for Jewish women to do underground work, easier than for men. And when I say underground work, I mean underground work that was done outside the ghettos. Jews were imprisoned in ghettos or in camps, forced labor camps, concentration camps, death camps. They weren't allowed to be outside on the Aryan side. But it was easier for women to be on the Aryan side, and that is because it was easier for them to perform as non-Jews, to perform as Christians, in the story that I tell, as Catholic Poles. And there are three or four sort of broad reasons for this.
Yeah, go ahead. Tell us the reasons.
Sure. Jewish women were not circumcised. Jewish men were circumcised.
Okay, you got to help me with that because I'm picturing people at routine stops, you know, saying, take your pants down. I mean, is that what they were doing?
Yes. If a person on the outside was suspected of being a Jew, if a man was suspected, he was told at gunpoint to drop his pants. They refer to it as the pants drop test. There were even some underground surgeries where they tried to reverse circumcisions just to get around this.
Wow.
So women didn't have that threat. They didn't have that physical marker of their Jewishness on their body.
Right.
Yeah, so another factor is in the 1930s in Poland, education was mandatory for boys and girls up to eighth grade. But in many Jewish families, they sent their sons to private Jewish schools, but they sent their daughters to public Polish schools, and that was largely to save on tuition. It was felt it wasn't as important for girls to have a religious education. But in these public Polish schools, this is actually women developed wonderful skills. They became more assimilated. They became more acculturated. So Jewish girls, who then became the freedom fighters that I write about, grew up aware of Catholic custom, Catholic habits, and very important, they say they learned to speak Polish like a Pole.
Of course they did.
They didn't speak in they always say this, the creaky Yiddish accent. And so this, again, helped them go undercover, helped them disguise themselves as being Christian.
Now, some of this, you talk about physical appearance also playing a role. Not just anyone would get away with this as well, right?
Women, they had to look the part. They had to look Christian. They used to call it, they had a good look was the term they used. Lighter hair, lighter colored eyes. And even in their comportment, they had to stand tall. They had to look confident. They had to have rosy cheeks and smile. So certain things, they could dye their hair, which they did. They talk a lot about trying to dye their roots and their hair and even coloring their faces and makeup. But they also had to be women who could perform confidence, composure. They had to appear to be entirely not scared.
Well, that gives us an opening to go to the woman who is the backbone of your book, and I'm going to take a shot at her name. And just for fun, okay? Renea Kukilka.
That was pretty good.
All right, fix it for me.
I mean, I call her Renea Kukilka.
Well, I didn't do too bad. Okay, Kukilka. So Renea, tell us about Renea.
So Renia was about 14, 15 when Hitler invaded Poland. But she was, she was sent to a ghetto with her family immediately. It was, she lived through very violent experiences. But she was defiant from the start. She would sneak out of the ghetto to trade family heirlooms for food for her family. Her family knew they were going to be killed. And in the summer of 1942, she snuck out of the ghetto for good. She left. She fled. She looked good as we were saying. So she pretended to be Christian. She lived in forests. She got on trains. She was recognized. Someone from her hometown recognized her, and she picked up the valise next to her, got up, walked to the end of the train, and jumped right off. She was very, very daring. Rania got a job as a housekeeper for a half-German family, but she really wanted to be with her sister. And her sister was part of the underground in this town of Bijin in southwest Poland. And she managed to connect with her sister. Her sister brought her over. And when Rania got there, the underground in Bijin was planning a revolt. And they needed a young woman who could pass as Christian to take on the role of courier girl for them. And this,
I want to interrupt you. We'll come back to courier girls, but I want to interrupt you for clarification. You have just taken us to a small village, and you're talking about a revolt, which means that there were ghettos all over Poland. I always think of Warsaw as being the ghetto, but did they actually have the same structure?
There were over 400 ghettos in Poland. Almost every small town had a ghetto. They were all over Poland.
How did they structure that? Did they actually have, like, fencing around it?
Every ghetto was a little bit different. Every ghetto was a prison. Jews were not allowed to leave, so they were guarded and bordered and bound, sometimes with existing buildings, sometimes with landscape. There was a river on one side. Sometimes there were gates. Sometimes there were fences. Sometimes walls were built. It depends on the landscape and architecture of the particular place.
How did food get in?
A lot of times food did not get in. People were starving. Death from starvation was the main killer in the ghettos, especially in the earlier parts of the war.
So we're talking like 39 to 42 right now.
Yes, roughly.
Okay. And then after 42, then the systematic Holocaust begins, where the game is up.
Well, then there's a more systematic murdering of Jews.
Yeah. Okay. So now take us back to the courier role that Rania and many other girls played.
Sure. So the couriers were these young Jewish women who were, you know, Rania's age. She was 18 at the time. Who would, again, pretend to be Christian and slip out of the ghettos. And they would, first of all, connect the ghettos. So they would connect the communities. They would bring information. They would get information. They would bring the news. Jews in ghettos were not allowed to have newspapers or radios. It was often these young Jewish women who were bringing the news of the genocide, the news of the Nazis' plan. They also brought supplies. They brought fake papers, fake Aryan IDs, so Jews could use them and pretend to be Christian and try to escape the ghettos themselves. They brought medical supplies, and they also were the ones to arm the ghetto undergrounds. They were the ones who often left. They actually purchased arms from weapons dealers. Rania went to the Warsaw Cemetery and bought guns, explosives, bullets, ammunition, and these women would hide them in their purse and tape them to their torso, hide them in handbags, in their pockets, in teddy bears, in purses, in loaves of bread, under buckets of a sack of potatoes. They would hide weapons and get back on trains and bring them back into the ghettos to help arm the undergrounds.
You just opened up a whole new world that had not even occurred to me here. You just said they bought weapons from weapons dealers. We're talking during the Nazi occupation. She went to a cemetery, probably the dead of night. There was a black market of weapons that who was selling and buying these weapons?
Yes, there was a black market of weapons. And there was, I discuss this more in detail in the book. There were a whole range of ways that weapons were obtained, that weapons were purchased. Some of the weapons came from the Polish underground. there's one resistance fighter. He said, there, you know, people said, how can we fight? We have no guns. And he said, oh, there are loads of guns around. We just have to get them. And this is what they did. There were some Jews worked in forced labor in weapons repair shops, in weapons factories. And so people smuggled out of those factories. They smuggled them for the underground. Some other people smuggled them to sell them. People took weapons off soldiers. There was all kinds of black markets of weapons.
Okay. And was there active cooperation between Jewish resistors and the Polish underground? That's a delicate question, isn't it?
That's like a two-hour question.
Yeah. It's also one that is diplomatically very dicey, right?
Well, you know, there wasn't one Polish underground. There were two main Polish undergrounds. They themselves didn't work together or always get along with each other. There was the Home Army and the People's Army. One was considered more sort of nationalist. They had a headquarters functioning out of London. And the People's Army was a more communist resistance, who were more affiliated with Russia.
Sure.
And they themselves didn't always get along. And the Jewish underground, when we talk about the underground, there were many factions of the underground. There were many different groups, and they themselves didn't always get along. And it depends on the ghetto. It depends on the specific place, on the context, on the time. So throughout this whole story, what we see is that there were many, many different resistance groups and undergrounds through all of occupied Poland. And sometimes they worked together, and there were collaborations, and sometimes there weren't. And there were, you know, either outright betrayals or just refusals.
The classic story of that is in Yugoslavia. We don't have to get into that. But that was a case where they were at each other's throats the whole war. Take me back to Renia's story. One of the things that's striking about this is that some of these women survive. You know, we think of people who resisted actively, that they would just be extinguished one by one. But some of these people actually survived and survived the war and ended up living a long life.
I mean, most of them were killed. Most Jews in Poland were killed. But some did survive. And those are the ones that I focused on in the book because they were able to tell their stories or left stories, though I also used some manuscripts and diaries that were written during the war, and the diaries survived where the women didn't. But for the most part, yes, some women did survive, and I was very interested in how they survived, not just how they got out, but how they went on living, how they recreated their lives after what they had been through, the trauma and the drama. And the whole final section of my book looks at, you know, how did they survive surviving, or did they?
Yeah. Tell me about Renia's escape before we get to that question of surviving. Renia's escape was, I imagine that attracted the attention of the movie makers.
Renia's escape was very dramatic, and I'm always like, I don't know if I should tell you.
That's true. No. You make the call. All right, look, we'll just say she got out, made her way to Palestine. Is she the one who lived to be 90 years old?
Most of the women who survived lived to be in their 90s.
Yeah. Okay, dramatic escape for Renia, and she survives. We'll give away that she survived, but you've got to read the book or see the movie. Tell me about Bella Herzon.
Oh, Bella Herzon. I love her story. Bella Herzon was she also looked good. She was tall and blonde, and she was part of the underground from the get-go. Because she looked so good, they stationed her to live on the Aryan side, to completely do all her work on the Aryan side, and they sent her to a town of Grudno in Poland. And she was pretending to be a Catholic Polish girl. She's about 19 at the time, and she, you know, I mean, this pretense was 24/7. It was a constant acting job. So she had to rent a room. She had to get a job, because that's what a young Polish Catholic woman would do at that time. So she went to the town's employment office to get her day job and to apply for a day job. And they said, oh, we have the perfect job for you. You can be a translator and receptionist for the Gestapo.
Oh, my gosh.
So she gets a job working in the Grodno Gestapo headquarters. She brings them tea. She does some translation work for them. She's basically a secretary in the office. And, of course, what she also does is steals their documents. And she steals, you know, examples of passports and their stamps, official stamps, and travel papers and permits. And she brings these to the Jewish underground. They have these forgery, like, laboratories. When I say laboratory, you know, makeshift laboratories. But they used to copy these documents so that for themselves, so that they, as part of the underground, would be able to travel the country, get on trains, leave the ghettos, and when they could, for other Jews as well, to supply fake documents to give them Aryan identities. So she also, Bella also was, I mean, a courier of information and bulletins and weapons. She used to hide bulletins, underground bulletins. She would braid them in her blonde hair.
She was a natural blonde.
Yes, she was a blonde. One man in the Gestapo in Grodno took a liking to her. He, you know, developed romantic feelings for her. And so he invited her to the Gestapo Christmas party. And again, she couldn't say no. That would seem unusual. So nothing could be suspect, you know. You had to just go with it, blend in. So that night, it so happened that two other courier girls were staying in her room while they were on missions across Poland. So all three of them dressed up and disguised as Christian girls went to this Gestapo Christmas party in 1941. And I have a photo of them at the party in the book.
If you have the mobility and the capacity and the guts to do what these girls are doing, they could have gotten out and gone to Switzerland or Palestine, right?
I mean, not everyone could have. Some of them tried and were killed. Some of them could have. Some of them did. Frumka Plotnicka, she was a leader in the young Polish Jewish community before the war. And when Hitler invaded, she, like many of these groups, she fled east. In fact, that's where my grandparents also fled east. She was 25 at the time, so she was older. She was a leader figure, and she made it across to Belarusian territory. At that time, that was safe. And a few weeks into it, she couldn't take it. She couldn't take having fled. She felt so responsible for her people, for her community, that she smuggled herself back into Nazi-occupied Poland, back into Warsaw, and became a leader in the Warsaw Ghetto. She was known as Die Mama in Yiddish, the mother. And she also traveled the country. She put on a kerchief and makeup and tried to hide her Jewish features. She would visit different ghettos, bring information, run seminars, give lectures. And she was one of the first people to smuggle weapons into the Warsaw Ghetto. And then she ended up in Bidzin as well, leading the underground there.
Judy Battalion is author of The Light of Days, The Untold Story of Women Resistance Fighters in Hitler's Ghetto. Maybe you got the memo that says plant trees. There's so much to talk about. The complex interworkings of trees with air and earth and insects and birds and more. We're going to talk about the reasons for planting those trees, oaks in particular. That's Monday on Constant Wonder. Our show is a production of BYU Radio.